"What's wrong?" Molly said in alarm. He had ceased rising. "I have to go back," he said.
"Don't let it draw you down. That's the terrible thing it does. Its valence works on you. Climb!"
She tore her hand away from his and, kicking vigorously, ascended past him toward the surface above. Her legs kicked as if she were trying to shake loose some binding substance, something which mired her down here. "You go on up," Joe said. He sank, lower and lower, his eyes never leaving the pot. And steadily he focused his torch on it. It had coral around it, but for the most part it remained uncovered, as if, he thought, it was here waiting for me, trying to ensnare me the best possible way through the thing I love most. Molly hesitated above him, then reluctantly descended until she was parallel with him.
"What?"
she began, and then she too saw the pot. She gasped.
"It's a volute crater," Joe said, "very large."
Already he could distinguish colors emanating from it toward him, the colors which bound him more firmly to this spot than all the cords and seaweed, all the other snares. He sank, and sank some more.
"What can you tell about it?" Molly asked.
They had almost reached the pot. Joe's arms extended themselves as if acting on their own will.
"Is it—"
"Not earthenware," Joe said. "It's been fired past 500 degrees centigrade. It may even have been fired at a temperature as high as 1250 degrees. That's a great deal of vitrification over and above the glaze." Now he touched it. Carefully he tugged at it, but the coral held it tight. "Stoneware," he decided. "Not porcelain. It's not translucent. The white of the glaze makes me think, as a guess, that it's a stannic oxide compound. If so, it would be a majolica ceramic piece. Tin enameling, it's generally called. Like the Delft ceramic offerings." He rubbed the surface of the pot. "From the feel, I'd say it's sgraffito ware, with a lead glaze. See, the pattern has been incised through the slip, disclosing the body color beneath. As I say, this is a volute crater, but with it here we can probably expect to find sicters and amphoras as well. It's just a question of removing the coral deposits and seeing what's below."
"Is it a good pot?" Molly asked. "I mean, to me it looks unique. I think it's terribly pretty. But in your expert opinion—"
"It's superb," he said simply. "The red glaze is probably from reduced copper. It passed through a reducing atmosphere in the kiln. And ferrous iron. Look at the black. And the yellow, of course, is obtained from antimony, which produces an excellent yellow." "The color of glaze," he reflected, "which attracts me the most. The yellows, the blues. I will never change." He thought, "It's almost as if someone put this here for me to find." He rubbed the surface on and on, appreciating it by tactile sense impressions rather than sight. "Cupric oxide blues," he said to himself. "This pot has everything but that." "Did Glimmung have this put here?" he asked himself. To Molly he said, "Has coral been removed from this recently? It seems strange it wasn't completely covered." For a time Molly poked about the pot, examining its surface and that of the coral holding it from below. As she did so, he studied the design on the pot. A complex and ornate scene, more ornate even than the Istoriato style of Urbino. What did the scene show? He studied it, pondering. Not all of the design was visible. And yet, he was accustomed to filling in missing segments removed from pottery pieces. What does this tell? He asked himself. A story, but of what? He peered.
"I don't like the amount of black on it," Molly said all at once. "Anything black down here undermines my sense of security."
She floated away from the pot, her examination over.
"Now can we go back up?" she asked.
Her tension had become even greater. It grew with each tick of the clock.
"I'm not going to stay down here and extinguish my life voluntarily for one damn dumb pot. Pots just aren't that important."
Joe said, "What did your examination show?"
"Coral has been stripped from it within the last 6 months."
She broke a section of coral away, revealing more of the pot.
"I can finish the job in a few minutes when I have my tools."
Now he saw more of the design. The first panel showed a man seated alone in a bleak and empty room. The next, an inter-system spacecraft of commercial design. The third showed a man, evidently the same man, fishing. It showed him lifting a huge black fish from the water. That was where the black glaze which Molly objected to came in, the enormous fish. The next panel he could not see. Coral blocked his view.
But something came after the lifting up of the giant black fish. Lifting the fish was not the end. There was at least one more panel, and perhaps two. "This is a flambé glaze," Joe said absently. "As I said before, of reduced copper. But in some places it looks almost like dead leaf glaze. If I didn't know better, I'd..."
"You pedantic fop," Molly said savagely. "You miserable nitwit, I'm going up."
She kicked away, rose, unfastened the cable which connected them, and was soon gone, her torch flashing above him. He found himself alone with the pot and the nearby black cathedral. Silence. And the utter abstention of activity. No fish moved near him. They seemed to shun the black cathedral and its environs. They are wise, he decided. As is Molly. Bending over the pot, he took hold with both hands and tugged mightily, his torch temporarily put aside. The pot broke into many pieces. The pieces drifted away in the ocean currents, and he found himself gazing down at the few still imprisoned fragments. Bracing himself, he grasped the remaining fragment and tore it forward, where the whole pot had been. The consolidated coral hung back. It kept its seizure of the fragment active. And then, by degrees, the coral released the fragment. It came loose in his hands, and at once he flailed for the surface above. He held in his hand the remaining two panels of the visual narrative. They ascended with him, held tight. Presently he broke through to the surface. He slid aside his mask, and floating about, examined the two panels by torchlight. "What is it?" Molly called, swimming toward him with long, lean strokes. "The rest of the pot," he said raspingly. The first panel showed the great black fish swallowing the man who had caught it. The second and final panel revealed the great fish once again. This time it devoured and absorbed a Glimmung, or rather the Glimmung. Both the man and Glimmung disappear down the throat of the fish, to be decomposed within its stomach. The man and Glimmung ceased. Only the great black fish remained. It had engulfed all. "This potsherd," he began, and then broke off. There was something that he had failed to see at first glance. That something now gathered his attention. It tugged at him, drawing him restlessly, impotently toward it. In the latter panel, a talk balloon had been incised above the fish's head. Words filled the talk balloon, words in his own language. He read them haltingly as he bobbed about upon the uneasy water. "Life on this planet is underwater, not on the land. Do not get involved with the fat fake calling himself Glimmung. The depths draw from the earth, and within those depths the real Glimmung can be found." And then, in very small letters, these words at the edge of the terminal panel. "This has been a public service message." "It's insane," Joe said as Molly swam up beside him. He felt like dropping the fragment of pot, letting it drift down and down into the dark, heavy water, out of sight once more. Peering over his shoulder, clinging roundly and wetly to him, Molly read the contents of the talk balloon. "Good God," she said and laughed. "It's like what it is you have on Earth, cookies, with messages in them." "Fortune cookies," Joe said savagely. "I read where someone in a Chinese restaurant on Earth, in the city San Francisco, opened a fortune cookie and the slip said, 'Abstain from fornication.'" Again she laughed, a warm, throaty laugh. At the same time she clutched at his shoulder, turning herself about so that she faced him. Now all at once she became calm and very serious. "It's going to make a terrible fight," she said, "to keep the cathedral down there." Joe said, "It doesn't want to come up. The cathedral, it wants to stay down there. This shard is a part of it." He dropped the fragment of pot, and at once it sank into oblivion below him. He watched for a second, saw only ebbing water, then turned back toward Molly once again. "That was the cathedral talking to us," he said. It was a somber thought, a thought he did not like.
"Didn't the pot belong to the black?"
"No," he said, "not from the black one." It had to be faced by all of them, himself, the others, and Glimmung. "I don't think he knows," Joe said aloud. "It's not merely a question of the Book of the Kalends, what they write as fate. It's not a problem in hydraulic engineering, either."
"The soul," Molly said faintly.
"What?" he demanded with anger.
"I guess I don't mean that," Molly said after a pause.
"You're damn right you don't," Joe said, "because it's not alive." Despite the message on the potsherd, he said to himself, "it's the semblance of life only, inertia. like any physical object, it remains where it's at until enough force is brought to bear against it. And then it moves, reluctantly. Below us, he thought, that cathedral contains a mass of infinite enormity, and we will break ourselves trying to move it. We will never recover, none of us, Glimmung included, and it will remain down there, he thought, as it is now. World without end, he thought, as they say in the church. But what a strange cathedral, he thought, to scratch messages on coral-encrusted pots. There must be a better way by which it can communicate to us up here, we who live on the land. And yet, Glimmung's way of communicating, his note bobbing around in the water closet of a toilet on Earth, that had been equally bizarre. A planet-wide propensity, he decided. An ethnic custom, probably sanctioned down through centuries. Molly said, "It knew you would find that pot." "How?" "In the Book of the Kalends, buried somewhere in a footnote halfway through, in squirrel agate type." "But, for example, they were wrong," Joe said, "when they said I would find something in Heldskala that would cause me to kill Glimmung. So it could only be a guess, and maybe a bad one." Yet, he thought, it did work out. I did find the pot. And maybe someday, he thought, the tidal currents of reality will sweep Glimmung and me along so that at last I kill him, if enough time elapses. In fact, he reflected, if enough time passes, everything will happen, which in a sense was the way the Kalends book worked. Worked and did not work. Probability, Joe said to himself, a science in itself. Bernoulli's theorem, the Bayes-Laplace theorem, the Poisson distribution, negative binomial distribution, coins and cards and birthdays, and at last random variables. And hanging over it all, the brooding specter of Rudolf Carnap and Hans Reichenbach, the Vienna Circle of Philosophy and the rise of symbolic logic. A muddy world in which he did not quite care to involve himself, in spite of the fact that it pertained immediately to the Book of the Kalends, muddier by far than the water realm which lapped at him and Molly. "Let's get back to the installation," Molly said, and shivered. She abruptly paddled off, leaving him. He saw, ahead of her, the lights which the robot Willis had previously turned on for their benefit. Those lights still burned. The robot waited for them. "Amelita did not get us," Joe reflected, as the two of them paddled toward the staging center with its blaze of lights. And for that he was thankful. It had been as awful as Willis, and Molly had said. His own corpse. He could still see, in his mind, the exposed jawbone as it waggled, white and dead, in the current of the aquatic subworld. Amelita's world, with its own laws, filled with refuse and everything half-dead. He reached the illuminated staging area with its three hermetically sealed domes, and there was Willis waiting to help him up. The robot seemed irritable as Joe and Molly removed their diving gear. "It's about time, sir and lady," Willis said fussily as it gathered up their equipment. "You disobeyed me and stayed too long." It corrected itself. "Disobeyed Glimmung, I mean." Joe said, "What's the matter with you?" "Oh, a goddamn radio station," Willis said. Now it worked with Molly's oxygen tanks. Its strong hands lifted them without effort. "Just consider this." It stripped her suit from her, gathered up everything, and began to lug it toward the supply locker. "I'm sitting here waiting for you to come up and listening to the radio. They're playing Beethoven's Ninth. Then there's a commercial for a hernia belt. Then the Good Friday music from Wagner's Parsifal. Then an ad for an ointment that cures athlete's foot. Then a chorale from the Bach cantata Jesu, du meine Seele. Then an ad for a rectal suppository used in the treatment of piles. Then Pergolesi's Stabat Mater. Then an ad for a false teeth dentifrice. Then the Sanctus from the Verdi Requiem. Then a laxative ad. Then the Gloria section from Haydn's Mass in Time of War. Then an ad for an analgesic used for female monthly disorders. Then a chorale from the St. Matthew Passion. Then an ad for cat litter. Then..." Abruptly, the robot ceased speaking. It tilted its head, as if listening. And now Joe heard it, and beside him Molly seemed to have heard it too. She turned swiftly, then loped to the building's entrance. Outside, in the meager light, she peered up. He followed after her. So did Willis. A huge bird hung in the night sky, containing two hoops, one of water, one of fire. Within the two, an adolescent female face gazed out, partially covered by its paisley shawl. Glimmung, as he had first appeared to Joe, yet now elevated into an enormous bird form. An eagle, Joe thought wonderingly, screaming as it came, plowing up the nocturnal sky with its talons. He moved backward a space into the security of the building's doorway. and still the great bird soared toward them, the right-angle hoops spinning with shrill intensity.
"It's the old fellow," Willis said, showing no anxiety. "I asked him to come. Or did he ask me? I forget. Anyhow, the two of us conversed, but it's a little blurred now in my mind. We have that problem, my colleagues and I."
Molly said, "He's landing."
The bird came to rest in the air, its beak working in spastic agitation. The yellow eyes glowered at Joe, specifically at Joe and no one else. And then from the huge craw of the bird, words came, shouted into the darkness of the night. Words, sharp and wild, a screech of interrogation.
"You!" the bird yelled at him. "I didn't want you to go into the ocean. I didn't want you to see what's there buried at the bottom. You are here to cure pots. What did you see? What did you do?"
The shrieks of the bird had a frantic quality about them, an overpowering urgency. Glimmung had come here because he could not wait to find out. He had to know at once what had happened at the bottom of the ocean.
"I found a pot," Joe said.
"The pot lied!" Glimmung shrieked. "Forget what it said. Listen to me instead. Do you understand?"
Joe said, "The pot only told me..."
"There are 1,000 lying pots down there," Glimmung broke in. "Each has a separate false tale to tell to anyone who happens to come by and notice it."
"A great black fish," Joe said. "It showed that."
"There is no fish. Nothing is real down there except Held Scala. I can bring it up any time. I can do it alone, with no help from you or from anyone. I can bring up each pot myself. I can free them one by one from the coral, and if they break, I can repair them or get someone who can. Shall I send you back to your cubicle to play your game, to deteriorate over the years, to sink into decay gradually over the years until you become debris, without mind or plans? Is that what you want?"
"No," Joe said, "that's not what I want."
"You are going back to Terra,"
Glimmung shrilled. The beak snapped open and shut, biting the air savagely.
"I'm sorry I—" Joe began, but the bird cut him off with ruthless fury, and as before, with overwhelming agitation.
"I will return you to the crate in my basement," Glimmung declared. "You can stay there until the police catch up with you. Further, I will tell them where you are. They will get you, and they will reduce you to tatters. Do you understand? Didn't it occur to you that if you disobeyed me, I'd expel you? I have no use for you. As far as I'm concerned, you no longer exist. I'm sorry to yell at you this way, but this is the way I get when I'm thoroughly teed off. You'll have to excuse me."
Joe said, "It seems to me you've gone overboard. What, in fact, have I done? I went below, I found a pot, I—"
"You found the pot I didn't want you to see."
The frigid eyes of the bird bored relentlessly, stultifyingly down at him.
"Don't you see what you've done? You forced my hand. I have to react now. I can't wait."
All at once, the bird wheeled upward, spinning and realigning itself, turned now toward the sea rather than Joe. The bird shot outward at tremendous velocity. Its massive wings flapped with violent rage, and the bird soared, rose, and hovered. It hung in the sky above the sea, shrieking in wild, determined bursts of ear-piercing noise.
"Cavorting Carrie Carnes and his 6 phones won't help you now!"
the bird shrilled, as it hung in the dark sky, merging with the fog which rolled in, like waves, above the ocean surface.
"The radio audience doesn't know about you! The radio audience doesn't care about you!"
The bird wheeled, dropped lower. Something rose from the sea. Chapter 13.
"Oh, God," Molly said, standing close to Joe. "It's the black one, coming to meet him."
From the sea, the black Glimmung ascended, meeting the authentic Glimmung in midair. Feathers flew in all directions as the two creatures raked each other with their claws. Then, almost at once, the tangled mass of the two of them dropped like a stone into the water. On the surface, they thrashed momentarily, and it seemed to Joe, unless it was an illusion, that the authentic Glimmung was struggling to extricate himself. Both Glimmungs disappeared, out of sight, into the depths of Mare Nostrum.
"It pulled him under," Molly whispered in a stricken voice.
To the robot, Joe said, "Is there anything we can do to help him, to get him free?" "He's drowning," Joe realized. "This will kill him."
"He will emerge," the robot said.
"You can't be sure of that," Joe said. Molly beside him echoed his words. "Has this ever happened before?" Joe demanded. "Glimmung pulled under?"
Instead of lifting Heldskalla up, he realized, Glimmung had been dragged down, to join the Black Glimmung and the Black Cathedral forever. Like my corpse, a lifeless thing floating about in the form of mere debris, dwelling in a box.
"I can fire an HB cartridge into the water," the robot said, "but a warhead like that would kill him too."
"No," Molly said emphatically.
"This did happen once before," Willis said, reflecting. "In Terran time," it calculated, "late in 1936, about the time of the Summer Olympics held in Berlin that year."
Molly said, "And he made it back up?"
"Yes, Mrs. Lady," Willis answered. "And the black one slid back down to the bottom again, where it has remained until now. By coming here, Glimmung took a calculated risk. He knew it might disturb the black one. That's why he said you forced my hand. You did. It's been forced. He's down there now."
Flashing his torch out onto the water, Joe saw something bobbing about, an object which reflected light.
"Do you have a powerboat?" he asked Willis.
"Yes, Mr. Sir," the robot said.
"Do you want to go out there? What if they come boiling up?"
"I want to see what that is out there," Joe said. He already had a good idea. Grudgingly, the robot went off in search of the boat. A few minutes later, the three of them putt-putted their way out into the dark and turbulent surface of Mare Nostrum.
"There it is," Joe said, "a few yards to the right."
He held the object fixed with his torch as the boat approached it. Reaching out, he groped for the thing. His fingers closed over its handle, and he lifted it back into the boat. A large bottle, and in the bottle, a note.
"Another message from Glimmung," Joe said acidly as he unscrewed the lid of the bottle and dumped the note out. It fluttered onto the bottom of the boat, and he retrieved it carefully. Holding it in the light of the torch, he read it.
"Watch this place for hourly progress reports. Cordially, Glimmung. P.S. If I'm not up by morning, notify everybody that the project has been scrubbed. Get back to your own planets as best you can. My best to you all. G."
"Why does he do this?" Joe asked the robot. "Why does he leave notes in bottles and reach people via radio programs and..."
"An idiosyncratic method of interpersonal communication," the robot answered as they putt-putted back toward the staging center. "As long as I've known him, he's dribbled out opaque, elliptical chunks of information in indirect ways. In your opinion, how ought he to communicate? By satellite?"
"He might as well," Joe said, and felt gloom descend over him in a morbid, taciturn cloud.
He withdrew silently into himself. Shivering with cold, he awaited their arrival back at the staging area.
"He's going to die," Molly said quietly.
"Glimmung?" Joe asked. She nodded. In the dim light, her face seemed ghostly. Across it, vague shadows flitted, like ebbing tides.
"Did I ever tell you about the game?" Joe said.
"I'm sorry, at this moment I..."
"It works this way. You take a book title, preferably one well-known, and you feed it orally into a computer in Japan, which translates it into Japanese. Then you..."
"Is that what you're going back to?" Molly asked.
"Yes, it is," he said.
"I should feel sorry for you," Molly said. "But I can't.
You brought this on all of us. You've destroyed Glimmung, who meant to save you from your puerile pastimes. He meant to restore the dignity of work to you in a heroic enterprise, a joint enterprise involving hundreds of us from a multitude of planets."
"But Mr. Sir had to go below," the robot said.
"Exactly," Molly said.
"The Book of the Kalends made me do it," Joe said.
"No, it didn't," the robot said. "You had it in your mind to go below Mare Nostrum before the Kalends showed up and got you to read that passage in the book."
"A man must do what aids his humanity," Joe said.
"What does that mean?" Molly demanded.
"A figure of speech," Joe said lamely.
"What I mean is, like with the mountain climbers, it is there."
And now, he thought, I have killed Glimmung, as the book foretold. The Kaland was right. The Kalends are always right. Glimmung is dying as we sit here in this boat, putt-putting back to the staging area. Without me, without my descent into Mare Nostrum, he would be alive and functioning. They're right. It's my fault. As Glimmung himself said, there at the end, before the black Glimmung rose from the sea to do battle with him.
"How do you feel, Joe Fernwright?" Molly asked him.
"Knowing what you did, knowing what you are responsible for."
"Well," Joe said, "I suggest we keep watching the hourly progress reports." It sounded weak even to him. As he said it, his voice faded away, ebbed at last into silence.
The three of them continued on, no one speaking, until they reached the dock of the staging area and Willis was securing the boat.
"The hourly progress reports," Molly said sardonically as they climbed up onto the wharf.
The bright lights of the staging area blazed around them, giving Molly and Willis an unnatural cast, a kind of blanched lead aspect, as if they were mimicking human life in a macabre, unnatural way. Or, he thought, as if I've killed them too, and these are their corpses. But a robot, he decided, does not have a corpse. It's the lighting and the fact that I'm tired. He had never felt such exhaustion in his life. As he climbed, he wheezed for air, his lungs aching. It was as if he had tried by his own muscles to lift Glimmung out of the sea and back onto dry land. And safety. Which, he thought, Glimmung deserves.
"It's an interesting story," Joe said to change the subject, "about how Glimmung first contacted me. I was sitting in my cubicle with nothing to do, and the mail light lit up. I pressed the button, and down the pipe came..."
"Look," Molly interrupted quietly. Her voice was low but deeply intense. She pointed out over the water, and Joe turned his torch in that direction.
"It's frothing, from the struggle underneath. The black Glimmung swallows Glimmung. The black cathedral swallows the cathedral. Amelita and Borel are forgotten, and so is Glimmung. Nothing survives. Nothing comes back up out of the water."
She turned her back and continued on into the staging area.
"Just a moment," the robot said. "I think a call is coming through for Mr. Sir. As before, an official call."
The robot became silent, and then it said, "Glimmung's personal secretary. She wants to talk to you once again." The door of the robot's chest swung open, and as before, on its tray appeared the audio telephone. "Please pick up the receiver," the robot instructed. Once again, Joe picked up the receiver. He felt weights attached to his arms drag him down. He had to struggle to hold the receiver up high enough so that he could hear.
"Mr. Fernwright?"
The professional, adequate female voice.
"This is Hilda Rice again. Is Glimmung there with you?"
"Tell her," Molly said. "Tell her the truth." Joe said, "He's at the bottom of Mare Nostrum."
"Is that so, Mr. Fernwright? Do I understand you correctly?"
"He went down into the aquatic subworld," Joe said. "All of a sudden. None of us expected it."
"I don't think I'm understanding you properly," Miss Rice said. "You seem to be saying..."
"He's fighting with everything he's got," Joe said. "I'm sure he'll emerge eventually. He says he'll be sending up hourly progress reports, so I don't think there's really too much to worry about."
"Mr. Fernwright," Miss Rice said briskly, "Glimmung only sends out hourly progress reports when he's in distress."
"Hmm," Joe said.
"Do you understand me?"
Miss Rice snapped.
"Yes,"
Joe nodded.
"Did he go under voluntarily, or was he dragged under?"
A little bit of both," Joe said. "There was a confrontation." He gesticulated, finding it difficult to bring forth the right words.
Between the two of them. But Glimmung decidedly seemed to have the upper hand, or should I say pseudopodium.
"Let me talk to her," Molly said. She seized the phone, tugged it from his hand, and spoke into it.
"This is Miss Yoyes."
After an interval of silence.
"Yes, Miss Rice, I know that. Yes, I know that too. Well, as Mr. Fernwright says, he may emerge victorious. We must have faith, as the Bible says."
Again, a prolonged period of listening. Then she glanced up at Joe, held her hand over the mouthpiece of the phone, said,
"She wants us to try to get a message down to Glimmung."
"What message?" Joe said. Into the phone, Molly said,
"What message?"
"No message," Joe said to Willis, "is going to be of any help to him. There isn't anything we can do." He felt utterly impotent, more so than at any other time of his life. The sense of the proximity of death, which had haunted him during his depressed periods, dilated in him, and in undismayed fury, he felt it numb his guts, his heart, his nervous system. Awareness of guilt clung to him like a satin ornate cloak. Shame so pure that it had virtually an archetypal quality to it, as if he were re-experiencing the primordial shame of Adam, the first sense of conspicuousness before the sight of God. He felt hatred for himself, for the fecklessness of his conduct. He had brought his benefactor into jeopardy, and the entire planet as well. "I'm a Jonah," he said to himself. "The Kalends are right. I've come here to blight this planet with my presence." And Glimmung must have known. "Yet he brought me here anyhow. Perhaps because I needed this, for my sake." "Christ," he thought. "And this is now the end. Look how I've paid him back. With death." Molly hung up the phone. Her face, strained and taut, moved until she confronted Joe Fernwright directly.
she gazed at him without blinking for a long, long time. She gazed at him with fire-swollen intensity, and then, spent, she shuddered and ducked her head down as if swallowing.
"Joe," she said huskily, "Miss Rice says for us to give up, to leave here and go back to the Olympia Hotel for our things, and then—"
She paused, her face knotting profoundly.
"And then leave Plowman's planet and return to our own worlds."
"Why?" Joe said.
"Because there's no hope. And once Glimmung is—"
she made a convulsive gesture—
"is dead, then the scourge will descend on everybody on the planet, so we should get, you know, out."
Joe said, "But the note in the bottle said to watch for hourly progress reports."
"There will be no progress reports."
"Why not?" She said nothing. She did not amplify. Chilled with fear, Joe said, "Is she going to leave?"
"Yes, but first Miss Rice will be staying behind to route everybody to the spaceport. There's an inter-system ship that can begin loading at any time. She hopes to have everyone on it within the next hour."
To Willis, Molly said, "Call me a taxi." "You have to say, 'Willis, call me a taxi,'" the robot said.
"Willis, call me a taxi."
"You're leaving?" Joe asked. He felt surprise and, in addition, a further sinking of his life sense.
"We've been told to," Molly said simply.
Joe said, "We've been told to watch for hourly progress reports."
"You damn fool," Molly said.
"I intend to stay here," Joe said.
"All right, stay here."
To Willis, she said, "Did you call for a cab?"
"You have to say, 'Willis, did you call for a cab?'"
"They're all busy," the robot said, "shuttling people from every corner of this rustport." Joe said, "Let her have the vehicle you and I came here in."
"Then you're sure you don't intend to leave?" the robot asked.
"I'm sure," Joe said.
"I think I can follow your reasoning," Molly said. "It was you who made this come about, this trouble crisis. So you feel it would be immoral to leave, to save yourself."
"No," he said. Truthfully, he said, "I'm too tired. I can't face going back home. I'll take a calculated risk. If Glimmung returns to dry land, then we can continue with the raising of Held Scala. If not—" He shrugged.
"Fake bravery," Molly said.
"Fake nothing, just weariness. Get going, take off for the spaceport. The end could come any minute, as you well know."
"Well, anyhow, that's what Miss Rice told me," Molly said, somewhat apologetically.
She loitered, clearly divided in her mind as to what to do.
"If I stay—"
she began, but Joe cut her off. "You're not staying, you and everyone else, except me."
"May I interpose a point?" Willis inquired.
Neither of them replied, so it continued. "It was never Glimmung's intention that anyone die with him, hence Miss Rice's instructions to all of you. She is following his dictates. Undoubtedly he left a standing order with her that if he were killed, she would get everyone off the planet, hopefully in time. Do you see, Mr. Sir?"
"I see," Joe said.
"Then you'll leave with Miss Lady?"
"No," Joe said. "Terrans are known for their stupidity," Molly said scathingly. "Willis, drive me to the spaceport direct. I'll leave my things in my apartment. Let's go."
"Goodbye, Mr. Sir," Willis said to Joe.
"Ratchavruck," Joe said.
"What does that mean?" Molly demanded. "Nothing. An archaic drollery." He walked away from the two of them to the wharf. Standing there, he gazed sightlessly down at the moored boat, and in it the bottle and note. "Ratchavruck to me, too," he thought. "It was never a very good drollery, anyhow," he said to no one in particular. "To Glimmung," he thought. "Luck to him, down in Mare Nostrum, where I ought to be, where we all should be, fighting as he is fighting, the black entities that have never lived. Death on the move," he thought, "animated death, death with an appetite." He said aloud, "Cursed with an appetite keen I am." They had gone. He stood alone in the staging center. And presently he heard rockets, a low murmur of power that shook the building. They had taken off. "From Princess Ida," he said to no one, "sung by Cyril in Act Two in the gardens of Castle Adamant." He was silent then, listening. He could no longer hear rockets. "What a hell of a thing," he thought. "A really lousy hell of a thing. And I brought it on. The book made a pool ball out of me, an object set in motion as in Aristotle's view of the world. One moving pool ball hits the next. It hits a third. That is the essence of life.
Would Molly and Willis have known what he was quoting from? Molly, no. But Willis was familiar with Yeats. Surely it would be equally familiar with W.S. Gilbert. Yeats. He then thought this. Question, do you like Yeats? Answer, I don't know, I've never tried any. For a time his mind was empty, and then he thought this. Question, do you like Kipling? Answer, I don't know, I've never kippled. Anguish and despair filled him as these thoughts passed through his brain. I've gone mad, he said to himself. Only rubbish occupies my attention. I'm flattened by pain. What is going on down there? He stood on the dock, gazing out across the water. Firm and smooth, the surface hid anything beneath. He could get no idea from what he saw, no understanding. And then, a quarter of a mile from the staging area, the water began violently to churn. Something huge rose to the surface, thrashed about, and then tore itself loose. The vast object spread wings which beat ineffectually. The wings continued beating slowly as if the creature were exhausted. And then, in a ragged, careening flight, the thing rose up. It pumped its wings up and down, and yet it did not rise more than a few feet from the surface. Glimmung? He strained to see as the thing drew closer. It pumped and flapped until it reached a dome of the staging area. It did not land, however. Laboriously, it continued past. He heard and felt it go by overhead in the night's darkness. At the same time, an automatic alarm, triggered by the thing's proximity, tripped on. A recorded stentorian voice began to speak from horns here and there throughout the structure. Attention! A false Glimmung is active. Take emergency procedures under Condition 3. Attention! A false Glimmung! It boomed on and on. The flailing, thrashing object which had risen from the sea was not Glimmung. Chapter 14. The worst alternative had come about. Glimmung had been defeated. He realized it as he heard the alarm and listened to the heavy rustle of giant, preoccupied wings. The thing had a mission. It was heading in a calculated direction. Where? Joe wondered. Reflexively, he cringed. Even without landing, it cast terrible weight over the planet's surface, and over him as well. It seemed as if he bore the thing, at least momentarily. It's not interested in me, he said to himself, as he crouched, eyes shut, his body drawn into a fetal position. He said aloud, Glimmung! There was no answer. It's heading toward the spaceport, he said to himself. They will never leave this planet. Going that way, he sensed the determination in its exhausted straining. Glimmung had damaged it but not destroyed it, and Glimmung lay at the bottom of Mare Nostrum, probably, almost certainly, dying. I've got to go below, Joe realized. I have to dive once more to see if there's anything I can do for him. Frantically, he began collecting his previous diving gear. He found oxygen tanks, the transparent mask, flippers, his torch. He located weights to fix his belt. Feverishly, he worked. And as he crept into the skin-tight suit, he realized that it didn't matter. He was too late. And, he thought, even if I find him, I have no way of grappling him. I have no hoist by which to bring him up. And who can heal him? Not me. Not anyone. He gave up. He began stripping the suit and weighted belt from him. His half-paralyzed fingers plucked at the zipper. The job of desuiting lay almost beyond his capacity. A disaster of a trade, he thought. Glimmung now on the ocean bottom, the black Glimmung, the false Glimmung, in charge of the sky. Everything has been reversed, and a dangerous situation has become a catastrophe. But at least, he thought, it didn't try to get me. It flapped on past, in search of greater prey. He gazed out across the water. He shone his torch on the spot where Glimmung and his antithesis had sunk. What appeared to be bits of hide and broken clumps of feathers shone pale and sticky in the light of the torch, and a deep stain eddying out in greater and greater circles like oil. Blood, he thought. The thing is hurt, all right, unless that's Glimmung's blood. Stiffly, his arms shaking, he managed to creep down into the moored powerboat. Presently he had putt-putted out to the spot. The blood slick glistened on all sides of his boat as he shut off the power to the engine and merely drifted. The flotsam told him nothing. Even so, he remained there, listening to the sound of waves flopping blindly against a dark coastline somewhere behind him. Experimentally, he reached his hand down into the water and brought it out. The slime in torchlight looked black, but it was blood, fresh blood, and lots of it, blood from something which had been permanently maimed, beyond hope of recovery. It,
Whoever lost this blood will die in a matter of days, he decided. Or possibly hours. From the depths of the ocean, a bottle floated up. At once he spotted it with his torch, snapped the power onto the engine, and putt-putted toward it. Reaching, he lifted the bottle into the boat. A note. He uncorked the bottle, shook the note out into his waiting hand. By torchlight, he read it. Good news! I have routed the opposition and am presently recuperating. In disbelief, he reread the words. Is it a gag? He wondered. Fake bravado at a time like this? And that was exactly what the pot had called Glimmung, a fake. And by extension, the note itself a forgery, not really from Glimmung. Like the words on the pot, this could be a product of the cathedral. Not the black counterpart, but by the held scala which Glimmung intended, or had intended, to raise. I have routed the opposition, he echoed in his mind as he reread the note once again. There's a credibility gap here, he decided. The enemy, as it thrashed its way out of the water and into the air, had seemed damaged, but not mortally so. It was Glimmung, unable to ascend from the ocean floor, who seemed to Joe to be mortally damaged, despite this note. A second bottle, smaller than the previous two, floated to the surface. He sequestered it, unscrewed the lid, and read the brief note within. The previous communique is not a forgery. I am in good health, and hope you are the same. G. P.S. It will no longer be necessary for anyone to leave the planet. Notify them that I am all right, and tell them to stay in their living areas for the time being. G. But it's too late, Joe said aloud. They're leaving right now. Glimmung, you waited too long. I am the only one left. I and the robots, in particular Willis. And we are not much. Nothing at all compared with the gigantic and varied crew which you assembled for the task of raising Held Scala. Your project has come to an end. And what was more, this note could be a forgery, too.